Well, you're absolutely right. Texture can include vocals. In this case, I'm actually talking purely about the instrumental textures. To me and to other people who write about the Montreal NDC, there are aspects of it which are texturally unique and which seem to be widespread in that scene. Now, they don't often call it texture. They use these other adjectives that I talked about. They talk about lushness and things like that, which I think boil down, if you question them, boil down to being about instrumental texture. Both Arcade Fire, especially Arcade Fire, very famously, has a great number of sort of non-standard rock instruments, violins and stuff like that. Stars as well tend to use various kinds of acoustic strings, cellos, and stuff like that. So I'm talking in this case really about the ways that they use in the recordings, at least, to some extent the live shows too, but much more the recordings, they use these different kinds of instrumentation to create this kind of soundscape. I almost fear using that word, but creating this kind of soundscape with the crisscrossing of these different instruments. So that's ultimately what I'm talking about with texture. You could include the voices, but actually in this case, I think the voices are probably less important than the musical instruments.
Yeah, Vincent?
Yeah, thank you for a very interesting talk and showing us that technical difficulties can happen to the best of us, so it's kind of reassuring. I was wondering about your theory and the things that you discussed in relation to possible risk into regression into determinism, form of determinism. Like, okay, if you go to Montreal, then it will sound like this, or kind of a turnaround of the things that you've discussed. Of course, you try to avoid it by saying that, things can be predicted, and there are lots of indeterminate terms in this whole process. But I can imagine that, this risk of determinism is always brewing around the corner. I don't know how you feel about
Well, there must be some truth to what you said, because I'm often faced with this question.
So it's almost a determinism in itself.
Yes. Clearly, my theories can sometimes seem causally overbearing. I have to say that I don't have the same objections to determinism that most people do. For example, I'm not ready to reject it simply because it's morally offensive, because we might be in a bad world. Then again, I'm not trying to claim something that's quite determinative to that extent. I'm trying to look at a kind of a balance between these shared values on the one hand, and on the other hand, this ideology of individuation, especially in the indie world, of all places, to think of indie bands as resembling each other, and that's almost death. I'm trying to balance that with the ideology of individuation and see things diverge, but of course, because of the kind of theory I'm putting forward, I'm putting a lot more emphasis on the convergence and the things that are shared. But you're absolutely right. I mean, even without deciding the question whether we have any freedom, if we don't, we certainly don't have the ability to predict everything. So things might as well be somewhat random. And of course, there's lots of divergence. And of course, I cherry pick my examples. It could be that if you've got another indie scene, it would be much more difficult for me to make that kind of connection. And I'm certainly willing to believe that indie scenes vary in the extent to which they may shape the aesthetic priorities of people that work in them.
Rolf Grossmann, I have two questions. The first concerns the term texture that we use. Why do you use texture? In former times, we would have said it's a Montreal sound. What you explain. For me, texture is a special semantic quality of the surface, like you have in strong layered music like techno or ligeti atmosphere. So that's texture, and that it has a special semantic quality. That's the first question. The second question is the relationship between this examples that you have and the urban space. I have another example that seems to be a little deeper. The Notwist, you know, perhaps this German band, the Notwist.
Notwist, yes.
You know them.
I know of them, yes.
Okay. I think they have a special sound, and they come out of a little Bavarian small town. Not urban space, nothing at all. It's a rural region in Germany, and there has been a random encounter between some persons, and it evolves such a music, perhaps not so traditional as the music that you presented. So I would like to have a little bit more explanation. What's the relationship between that sound or this kind of music and the urban space?
Okay. Sure. About the texture thing, I've certainly heard texture used in the way that you use it, to refer not only to an arrangement of simultaneous sounds, but also to some sort of ethos that goes with it. I was using texture more in just the kind of technical, musicological way of referring to exactly that, just the combination of simultaneous sounding elements. That, to me, is what ties this together. I mean, I suppose you could say that there's something that resembles the texture in each of these, in your sense as well, including some sort of emotional ethos. But I'm not sure that would be anything that transcends the general phenomenon of indie rock, which tends to take certain emotional ground tones in the first place. And by the way, I hope all of you heard in the vocal style of Arcade Fire that kind of talking heads way of singing. I mean, that's something that actually is unique to Arcade Fire. So there certainly are a lot of things like that. About the Notwist example, look, you can have, I don't know them well enough to know whether this actually happened or not. You can have these kinds of learnings go on in all kinds of contexts, but all they really require is physical proximity. It doesn't have to be physical proximity in the city. The reason that urban geographers, and especially economic geographers, tend to relate the phenomenon of face-to-face learning and physical proximity with cities is that cities are the places that enact that on a certain scale that normally is needed to support, say, an industry. I mean, the origins of this come from way back in the late 19th century and sort of early economic geography that tried to determine where you should put factories within cities and stuff like that. So it's always been oriented towards cities, but it's really a scale thing, and it certainly doesn't mean that you can't have urban creativity, you know, in a rural place. That would be just a silly idea. But you do usually need some kind of scale for a certain amount of industrial production, which is why even when you have urban phenomena that are rural in their origin, they don't tend to get capitalized until they get urbanized. Right, their industrialization will always be an urban phenomenon. But of course, you can have creativity anywhere, even a person alone in a shack could potentially be creative.
Thanks, Cole.
Yes, thank you. I'm happy about the theoretical paper, but of course, as soon as examples come in, you start thinking of other examples and so on and so forth. And one of the things that struck me with literature examples is that they both relate to the same genre or same style. And to sort of take that potential determinist view further, discussing how, I'm wondering of your thoughts about discussing it further, to sort of the sound of a city across genres, either across time, and say Detroit, across time, where you have a Detroit sound changing, but being similar enough to be a Detroit sound across history, or at least a historical lifespan.
Are you talking about Motown to Detroit?
Motown to techno, for example. Okay. Yeah. And then on a simultaneous level, thinking of from free jazz to Jewish folk music at downtown New York, where you also have some kind of what you discussed as shared aesthetic judgment, the same musicians moving across genres and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Would that challenge, or would it expand, or would it? What would that kind of approach do to your framework?
Well, it would definitely cause me to face more accusations of being determinist. yes, I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, one of the things I'm sure you remember this famous Fabry genre article, and lots of sense of sort of discuss genre as not just being about sound, but also being about communities of producers and consumers. And I think that does happen in cities. I mean, Bas van Hoor, whose book I had up there at some point, he did his empirical study of electronic dance music producers and consumers in London and Berlin. It was relatively easy for him to define a field of study because the people that are involved in electronic dance music and electronica tend to be really devoted to it. They tend to have a lot of networks with other people that are fans of it or performers of it and so on. So that genres in cities are often kind of spatially delineated in certain ways. You have clubs that will specialize in certain music, or at least will be open to some musics, but not others. So that there is that kind of physical separation that you could argue makes it very difficult to get this ethos. But, I mean, that doesn't preclude circulation. And there are plenty of people who live in more than one genre world. And even if you don't live in a genre world, you do get exposed to the music through various ways. So it's not out of the question. But for me right now, it's a modest enough goal just to establish this within one genre. If I accomplish that, I'll be happy. Then maybe I can do a whole city thing. And then eventually I'll get to Detroit over 30 years. And at that point, I'll be thoroughly determined. I like determined. I think determinism is underrated, but that's a discussion for
another time. Can
I get back to your insight into your approach of researching on New York City? My question has two aspects. First aspect of the question, when you're talking about music in the city, how do you think or how do you tell now contextualize how this relates to aspects like the oral architecture? And very lesser. How did this period go? So the music aspect and the urban building sound aspect, if you will. This is the one side, and the other side, what we've learned from that, is the, if you will, political responsibility that urban planners and also researchers have when they're working together with, if you will, city branding, agencies of city branding companies. I know working at Teacher Research in Berlin. There's a big issue there. So it's on the one hand, it's great to have this branding, Berlin, sound city, whatever. But on the other hand, what does this really mean for the people living in there? Or is it just another branding group or whatever? So I think when you're going to Hamburg, you will also encounter these questions, because Hamburg is having this discussing, are we selling the city, or are we fashioning or designing the city in a profound way?
Well, your second question is a huge can of worms, but I will get into it. About the first question, I'm not that good with that. In my book, I tried to do a lot of that, and I think I did it okay at times and not so well at others. What I was trying to do there was less about architecture in a sheer way than it was about the transformations of social space in cities. So not necessarily new build, but some sort of transformed usage of a build. For example, the existence of multimedia stores, where you have cross-marketing of video with audio, with books, and what creation of that kind of space does to the musical aspect of that space. That's about as good as I get on the issue of architecture. I'm not very good on architecture as a sheer form. I'm more interested sort of in the remakings of things. And I suspect there are people in this room that can give a lot better answers about architecture, qua architecture, than I ever could. You're absolutely right about these remakings of cities. I mean, look, urban planners work for the town fathers, and I'm going to leave that gender. And they tend to be working in the interest of capital. If they ever started working against the interest of capital, they would not work. It's part of the job. And it's really a problem for a Marxist like me, because you could take my entire paper today and say I'm basically serving the interests of capital in talking about it in this way. And there's certainly some truth to that. One of the things that urban planners are supposed to take into account when they plan herbs is the sort of thing that you're talking about. Public goods, goods that transcend social class. Guess what? It almost never happens. Almost as if there were a fundamental contradiction there. I didn't mean almost. Usually about the best you can get from urban planning is concessions or moderation of sorts. There are exceptions. Amsterdam is one very interesting exception, which has a tradition of sustained urban planning going back to, I believe, the mid-19th century. If anyone here can correct me, I may be wrong about that, but I think it's mid-19th century, of really sort of cross-class planning. Which is one of the reasons it's a much more livable city than most other equally sort of prosperous cities in Europe, or important cities in Europe. But that's always an uphill battle. And yes, I suspect that most of the attempts to brand cities as music cities are really ultimately another kind of growth scheme. And one of the things, I should say, urban geographers are becoming more skeptical about this. Partially as a result of that Evans article, and possibly just having been doing this for so many decades, it becomes more difficult to repress certain things. But I think those cities that are still attempting to rebrand themselves as music cities are doing something very much like what you're suggesting.
And then it's Henry Yadimova.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your paper. Musical city, joint city. And first of all, a couple of comments and then one question. I was thinking about this creative environment, and I thought that it has so much, for example, to do also with scholars. I mean, if you can compare it to a different kind of creative environment, for example, how important it is to have this face-to-face connection. Very nice that you
conductor, the particular conductors whom I studied were Roger Norrington, Christopher Hogwood, and Yap Schroeder. Norrington and Hogwood at that time were very much London-based and had been for quite a while. We're talking about recordings now from about 81, 82. Not long after that, both of them started more international careers and, of course, have had thoroughly international careers now for a number of decades. But at that time, there was much more of a local basis for that kind of music making. Yap Schroeder was a strange example because he, by that time, already did have something of an international career. And actually, his recording is much more in the style of the American East Coast hip playing, because at that time he had been based at Yale University for a number of years and had been performing with a number of different period instrument bands from Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. Those of you who might be into that stuff might remember that the Smithsonian Institute created a bunch of records with Yap Schroeder. So he was a little bit more difficult to pin down as a local, but he I used actually much more as a foil to show that the London styles had much more continuity to that, at least in the way that they used orchestral ballads, the, you know, wind string ballads. I really had to narrow down my investigation of that, but you can always, of course, study other things. Tempo, phrasing, etc. Maybe I'll make a career for some day, but I'm not quite ready to do this now. But yes, absolutely. At that time, they weren't yet quite the international figures they are now. If you did it now, it would probably be much more difficult to do. And probably it would be more difficult to do now for a lot of musicians, because as you point out, many of them get around a lot more now than they did previously. It's still relevant. I had an ex-doctoral advisee of mine just finished her dissertation on the Conservatorium in Amsterdam, in which she found very many of the same sorts of things going on as recently as a couple of years ago. So there are still local music cultures and traditions, but to be sure, circulation very often disrupts and sort of makes that whole thing messy.
Yes, maybe I stand up. Thank you very much for this introduction, and I'm very happy to hear somebody approaching the urban topic not from Richard Florida perspective, on but something completely different. But I'd like, I'm thinking about these processes at a time when sustainability aspects are bringing in more and more social and cultural aspects. This means that these processes are really becoming important in urban development and planning. So I don't agree with you. I mean, this was the 80s and 90s were the really sort of capitalist boom, but in times of sustainability, these issues come into urban development and redevelopment. But I think this question that was raised between small cities and big cities, so I would like to ask you again, is there not in fundamental principle a completely different kind of process? I'm thinking of the urbanist Heyer and Reindorf. They talk about urban territory as when it really gets flourishing. It's when there is maybe a group of people characterizing the space, but when it's complex and open enough to bring in a lot of others. And in Montreal, you have the circus scene, you have the film scene, you have the art scene, you have a lot of things. Whereas in small towns in Sweden, I'm thinking of Fagersta, who brought about the Hives, and Eskilstuna, who brought about the band Kent, who have created, I mean, really tiny places like you were referring to. That's a completely other, I would argue, mechanism, socio-cultural mechanism. Or I would like to comment a little bit more on that, on the complexity of large cities, the processes, and what could happen in small places.
Sure. Yes. I don't think it's a completely different process, but I think it is a quantitatively different process. And I mean, I should say that same Bas van Hur, whom I mentioned before, is now doing his big project on small cities and on musical creation in small cities. So he could probably give a better answer than I could. He's based in Maastricht, so that might be part of what inspired his project. There are differences. One of them is something that you mentioned in connection with Montreal, which is that in a lot of smaller cities, you don't get a lot of that exchange between different art scenes. You sometimes won't have a certain kind of art scene, or if you have it, it will be extremely modest. You don't have quite as much circulation of the actors from small cities that you do in large cities. A lot of large cities tend to be networked together. You can have a small city and a large city networked together too, but networks tend to form for industrial reasons often between the larger cities. You tend to have a lot more people in small cities who don't move around quite as much. And that probably makes a lot of difference as well. There are a lot of things that are in common, and I think especially with music, this becomes important. Again, because of the relatively low level of codification that we have about musical performance. That, I think, probably is something that doesn't differentiate greatly between small cities and large cities. There are certain kinds of musical instruction that you can only do musically. Maybe not you can only do musically, but we only do musically. If there's a way to codify it, we just haven't done it. Maybe it's not true that it would be impossible. But those kinds of factors, I think, may argue that in music, the difference between small cities and large cities may not be as pronounced as it would be for certain other arts. But that's speculation. And so far, I've really been confining a lot of my studies to the larger cities. So what I'm saying, probably, I can say empirically, applies better for medium to large cities than for small ones. I do think it's true that you have to do a separate kind of investigation for small cities and take those things into account. So we'll let Bas do that. I'm a big city guy.
I think we will end on that note and say thank you very much to Adam Grimm for a fine lecture, and thank you for the responses.